Welcome to Keep the Faith. I'm Beth Gelman. Thank you for joining me as we examine religion, faith, spirituality, and what it means to believe, to hope, to search. In this space, you'll be hearing from artists and clergy, scientists, philosophers, and other seekers of meaning. We'll be exploring themes like prayer, ritual, grief, music, and wonder. But today, on our first episode, we are starting with the pragmatic, asking how religion is defined by different groups and people and the effect those definitions have on modern life. With me in the studio is Professor Charles McCrary, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and Humanities at Eckerd College. His research focuses on American religion, especially topics related to religious freedom, secularism, science, and race. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, when you tell people you're a professor of religious studies, what do they think you do, and what do you actually do?
Usually, I don't tell them what I am. I usually say professor of history, and then they say, oh, I didn't like history in school, and I go, okay, and then we stop talking. But if I entertain the conversation, oftentimes, I mean, religious studies is a strange field. Oftentimes people think that it's training people to go into ministry of some kind or another to be clergy, which it can be. That's one path that you can go. But religious studies, what I actually do, what the field is a field that is organized around its object of study, more so than its method, right? We're all studying something called religion, which gets very complicated in ways that we'll talk about in a sec. But my own methods are mostly historical. I'm a historian of religion with an interest in politics and the way that various entities define religion and the effects that that has on people. So I spend a lot of my time doing what basically looks like cultural history and sometimes political analysis in the contemporary moment.
That's so interesting. Could you tell us just a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in this field?
Sure. I started as a philosophy major at the University of North Dakota. And there we had, it was a pretty small department that was split between philosophy and religious studies. There are a lot of places like this that combined at some point. And so I was taking philosophy classes, but the religion classes were right there. So I took a few of those as well. You know, I came in, like in high school, I had all these questions about what the self is and how do we really know what's true, these kind of like big classic philosophical questions. And I found those interesting and wanted to continue pursuing those, but I found it a little too abstract and I wanted to study people doing things. And so I was just gradually more attracted to the religious studies classes because we were learning about all these different beliefs, but not just the beliefs, the communities that hold them and what they do with those beliefs, what kinds of rituals are attached to them, these kind of long histories of culture and politics and so on. And so I really got hooked on religious studies there as an undergrad and flitted around quite a bit, you know, a little bit of New Testament, a little bit of Buddhist philosophy. And eventually I wanted to study American religion and understand why Americans are the way they are, why our culture and politics and race and gender happen in the weird configurations that they do. Mm-hmm. And I think religion is a very good window into all of those things. So that was my angle, and that's basically what I'm still doing.
You've written about how slippery the word religion is. For our purposes today, how do you think about or define that term?
Personally, I am more interested in how other people define it and kind of tracking those differences. So a lot of my work focuses on religious freedom. And the reason I'm interested in religious freedom, why I got interested in grad school is that, you know, something happens when you go to grad school in religious studies, which is you take your first year methods and theories course and they tell you, okay, religion doesn't really exist. It's a made up category. And then you have this breakdown, and then most people just kind of get over it and go back to doing what they were doing. But I didn't know what to do, and so I figured the way out of this is, well, what I can do is I can study the way other people use that term, because that term matters quite a lot right. in the modern world. Religious freedom is perhaps the most obvious example. If you have a religion, you get to do stuff that otherwise you don't, right? You get accommodations and exemptions. And so there's all this back and forth in the courts, in the legislature about who counts, who gets to have a religion, and what do you get to do if you have a religion? Can you violate these laws? Do you get special protections? And what about these kind of marginal cases? What about people who are in so-called cults? Are they protected? Is that a real religion? What about a superstition? Well, it's not really religious, but it's kind of religious. What about spirituality? And so on. So I track those debates and how they work. I will say for scholars, though, just to be like a little bit more useful.
Thank you.
Sorry. When I'm teaching, when my students are asking, okay, what is a religion? I tend to think about styles of speech and, you know, discourse more broadly, the words people use to describe things that are making political claims in a way that has an extra kind of authority because it is transcendent. It's appealing to God or the gods or some higher order, something like that. There's like an extra weight to this kind of political argument. And then there are all the particular types of cultural and family and individual enactments that go along with that. The rituals, the culture, the texts, all of those. They're not extra. They're the substance of religion for a lot of people. But they're all kind of tied to the idea that there's something more than just the kind of mundane day-to-day human life. That extra element is what makes it religious for most scholars.
Something that's transcendent, that everyone agrees in their own religion.
Yeah.
What do you feel are the consequences when we call something religious versus cultural or moral or spiritual?
It depends on the context, but so to take the religious freedom example, you know, things are afforded, or certain people, certain practices get protections that you otherwise wouldn't get. So I think, for example, of like in Native American religious freedom cases, for example, there's been a lot that have to do with land use. So in Arizona, where I lived previously, there's been this long developing case that's been winding its way through the courts and back down and back up again, called Apache Stronghold. And they, part of their land was given away by the federal government to a copper mining company mm-hmm. that's going to destroy this sacred mountain. So they can make that argument and say, this is very important to us culturally, you shouldn't destroy the mountain.
Right.
But that probably won't get them anywhere. They could make right. a sovereignty argument and say, we're sovereign over this, which may or may not work. Or what they have been doing is using a free exercise of religion claim, saying, if you destroy this mountain, it will destroy our ability to practice our religion. And that's a lot more persuasive in mm-hmm. the American system than other types of arguments. So that's just one example of where there's real stakes to what is religious versus just cultural or ethnic or something like that.
So it's really interesting to me that you're talking about this in terms of arguments. Mm-hmm. In your articles and your book, Sincerely Held, American Secularism and Its Believers, you discuss how sincerity and belief became central to American ideas about religion. Because as you've said, these are arguments, but they're sincere arguments. Why do you think sincerity holds such power in our culture?
One reason that sincerity matters to the courts is because in the 1940s, I won't go into too much detail here, but I can give you more if you would like.
That's right.
There was this case that had to do with this group called the I Am Activity, or the I Am Movement. Mm-hmm. And their founder, this guy, Guy Ballard was his name, he made all kinds of claims which seemed to be outlandish. One of them was that he was immortal. After he died, his wife and son continued the movement, and they solicited donations, they took money, and they were arrested for mail fraud. Anyway, long story short, this case makes its way to the Supreme Court, and the lower courts had said, this is fraudulent because these beliefs aren't true. And the Supreme Court said, you know, I don't think we should get in the business of saying which beliefs are true and which aren't. That doesn't seem like the job of a secular court. And one of the justices says, you know, a lot of people believe things that other people might think to be ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so maybe even our own religious beliefs, we think they make sense, but other people might think they don't. So instead of testing the truth or the reasonableness of a religious belief, what you can test is, do people sincerely believe it? Mm-hmm. Do you actually believe that thing? Even if it seems to be ridiculous, well, if it's really religious and if you really believe it, that counts. And it affords, I think, more broadly in culture, not just in law, a kind of respect. I think we have this, that's one reason why religion is often not supposed to be talked about, because it's not a subject for debate. We respect people who believe things sincerely, but it also makes it harder to discuss, right? We can't have this conversation in public about, I believe this, you believe that. Instead, you just have to say, well, you really believe that, and I respect it. And so it makes it a bit of a conversation stopper, but also respected at the same time. So it's in a strange position.
Right. And I agree with you. A friend of mine told me she never feels safe when a conversation outside of church turns to religion. It feels as taboo as sex or death. But why do you think religion feels so intimate or even dangerous to talk about?
Well, to build on that question, I heard a professor say one time that all religious studies scholars think that religion is fundamentally about either sex or death.
Oh. So, well, there you are.
which I feel like is a bit of an overstatement. I don't really think about it that way. But she was presenting this to undergraduates. She said about half of them think it's sex and about half think it's death. I'm one of the sex ones. so perhaps that's one reason. But it is, I mean, our understanding of religion is that it's tied up with all of the most intimate parts of life. It's very private, which is actually a pretty unique way of thinking about it compared to a lot of other cultures around the world and historically. Mm-hmm. Even the idea that there is something called religion that's different from our other parts of public life is an inheritance of kind of Protestant European ideas that the church and the state should be separate, that what religion really is what an individual does in private. We have this idea. Whereas, you know, if you went to ancient India and said, what's your religious belief? That would not be a question that makes any sense, right? You perform rituals, you have these kind of texts, you have beliefs. It's all part of your political life. It's part of your family life. The public and private split does not exist in the same way.
Right.
But we have this idea now that there are certain things that should be private. They're family. They're individual. They take place in the home. Sex is one of those things. Religion is another of those things. And they don't belong in the public sphere. But of course, that line, that wall of separation is always very porous. And it turns out that things like religion and sex and death matter in public quite a lot and have a lot of political stakes. And so they make their way in.
Wow, that is great. I'm going to change the subject just for a minute to show that the recent Pew report shows that more people, especially young people, call themselves people of faith without belonging to any organized religion. What do you think distinguishes faith from religion?
Building on my previous answer, faith, I always think faith is an interesting synonym for religion because it's such a Protestant word in a lot of ways. Mm. You know, for the most part, like if you ask Jews, what is the most important part of your religion? They won't say faith. They won't call it my faith. I mean, they might say my faith, but it's about ritual and family. It's about those other things.
Right.
It's about the holidays. It's not a list of creedal beliefs. These are the things 1 through 10 that I believe most. For Protestants, though, faith is equal to religion. And so I think for a lot of people, they've taken that model and sort of extracted it from institutional settings, mm-hmm. like the church, and said, I have an individual faith. These are my beliefs. They're kind of spiritual, and that's what works for them as an individual. Mm-hmm. But in a strange way, I see that as a very Protestant way of acting.
So interesting. That's really interesting. Do you find yourself personally drawn to certain religious ideas, any that particularly strike a chord within you, or are you more interested in how religion operates within culture?
I'm more interested in how it operates in culture, especially in my work and in my teaching. I mean, when I teach classes at Eckerd, that's the angle. Although plenty of students find something useful for their own faith and belief and find something of interest to them on a kind of personal level.
Mm-hmm. When you study religion academically, do you think it deepens or distances your sense of wonder?
I think it's different for different people. I mean, for me, I have such a sense of wonder about the world in seeing how differently so many different people can understand it. We're all living in the same world, more or less, maybe less sometimes. But that so many people can find meaning in very old sacred texts, very new experiences, and remix those in such different ways. And there's so much religious creativity, some of which I think is very inspiring and beautiful, and some of mm-hmm. which is hateful. And mm-hmm. there's, but we're all kind of living in the same world and trying to make sense of it and trying to make meaning of it. And the fact that that can be done in so many different ways, I find that like very beautiful and inspiring, even if not all of the results of those experimentations are beautiful and inspiring.
That was a beautiful and inspiring statement, so thank you. I wish we had more time. There is so much more to ask, but that's all the time we have today. My thanks to Professor McCrary for this fascinating discussion and to all of you for listening. I hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, keep the faith.